Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we're going to discuss views from USA and Europe around the design of digital automation technologies and their implication for the future world. This episode is produced with the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future World, which is an interdisciplinary group of some 30 knowledgeable and highly qualified experts. It explores multiple emerging challenges in the area of the future of work by bringing together their perspective from the European Union and the United States. The TEG has been brought together by Bruegel and the German Marshall Fund of the United States with the financial support of the European Union. I'm happy to welcome today Maria Savona, who is Professor of Economics of Innovation at the Science Policy Research Unit of the University of Sussex Business School and Professor of Applied Economics at the Department of Economics and Finance at the Luis Guido Carli University in Rome, Italy. Hi, Maria. How are you?
Hi, Giuseppe. I'm super well. Thank you for organizing this.
And from the other side of the pond, I have David Otter, who is a Ford professor in the MIT Department of Economics. His scholarship explores the labor market impacts of technological change and globalization on job polarization, skill demands, earnings levels, and inequality, and electoral outcomes. David, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you, Giuseppe, and nice to speak with you, Maria.
And I'm really thrilled to have both of you here discussing about the impact of digital automation on jobs. In the past few weeks, the topic has again made a buzz when the research company OpenAI released a program called ChatGPT, which can carry out what look like natural language conversations. You can ask questions or make requests and get responses that are startlingly clear and even seem well-informed. ChatGPT is only the latest example of technology that seems to be able to carry out tasks that no long ago seemed to require the services not just of human beings, but of human beings with substantial formal education. In a recent opinion article in the New York Times, Paul Krugman has noted that in the past, the jobs replaced by technology tended to involve manual labor. Machines replace muscles. What if machines can take over a large chunk of what we have historically thought of as knowledge work? David, and Maria, I would like really to start with this provocative question by Paul Krugman just a few days ago in the New York Times. What is your take on that?
That's a great question, Giuseppe. Thank you so much. And I think I'd like to make 2 points on this, if I can. What is the key ingredients to probably to tackle this question, which is very interesting, is what kind of machines, what technology, what digital automation specifically we're talking about? Because this, they relate to humans in very different ways. And it is true that before it was the physical capital replacing manual labor. And now, for example, different nuances of this digital automation technologies can replace different or reconfigure different tasks. So, for example, there are machines like robots and robotization that can be, for example, replacing the sort of routinized segment of a surgeon, whereas the human side of this occupation will still perform tasks that are less routinized or intervene in emergency. And I was reading, for example, the role of a chatbot replacing a human bartender as a sort of receiving end of drunken confessions, right? But probably consumer preference would still prefer the human side of it. So I think it's this, to tackle this question, we have to first unpack what are the digital automation technologies that are actually impacting on different sectors and different activities. And I'm sure David will intervene much more on that. But the second point I wanted to make is, I think to tackle this question, we probably need to reflect a little bit more on what really makes human knowledge still unique and therefore unreplaceable. And in fact, it's something I would like to put forward and maybe discuss with David in the follow-up of this, is that, for example, the way I see it is that, quoting, for example, Dick Nelson, who has been working on the economics of knowledge for a long time, what characterizes human knowledge is a sort of collective memories of know-how that makes knowledge transferable and makes technological change, technological progress in this context. So probably one of the questions that I think it's interesting to raise related to yours is that, for example, now we are in a context where machine learning is characterized by a scale dimension of knowledge accumulation rather than a collective dimension of knowledge accumulation. And this is probably what makes the difference in the future work. So in the sense that this is what we might need to reflect upon. What is the changing boundaries of tacit and codified knowledge when it comes to the relationship between digital automation and human knowledge?
David, what is your take on that question?
Great. Okay. Thank you. So yeah, that was, I appreciated Maria's reflections on that. So I think, Krugman is asking the question, historically a lot of automation, was placed muscles, not, neurons. But in fact, that's not been, that doesn't characterize the last four decades of what automation has been about, which has actually been replacing neurons with transistors, doing all types of, information processing work that we used to think of exclusively of the human domain, whether it's, bookkeeping, whether it's search, whether it's, processing, documents, whether it's carrying out flexible tasks on a factory floor done by robots. So we actually know a lot about what happens when that occurs. We know that computerization, pre-AI, has contributed to a hollowing out of the job distribution throughout industrialized economies because it has reduced the demand for, production, operative, clerical, administrative support workers, right? Many middle-skill jobs that involved basically executing codified instructions with a lot of expertise. Whether that was in a factory, whether that was in an office. And the result of that hollowing out has been a kind of a bifurcation of the occupational structure. We have more people doing, professional and technical and managerial jobs that are augmented by access to information technology. And we have many more people doing kind of generic in-person services, food service, cleaning, security, entertainment, even, home health aid in some countries. And those jobs are numerous, but they're poorly paid. The most recent evidence, a well-known paper by Samoglu Restrepo, recently published in Econometrica, sort of shows we've known the quantitative side in terms of the change in occupational structure for a long time, but they demonstrate the wage side and how consequential this has been for the falling wages of non-college workers. So we have a sense of what can happen, and it's not particularly pretty. And it would be one thing if this had been accompanied by four decades of rapid productivity growth and rising real living standards. But that has not been the case in industrialized countries. So there have been real gains from some of these technologies, but they have been distributed in a very concentrated way. Most of the gains have gone to the top. And that's a function of many things. It's not necessarily intrinsic to the technology, although it contributes to that. So I guess I don't want to speak at too length, so let me kind of come to two points. One is the big problem that we face in many industrialized countries before AI, but AI is going to make this even more challenging, is the reduction in expert work for people without high levels of education. And so automation has not reduced the amount of employment per se, but it's reduced among people who don't have college degrees, it's moved them into work where they're less specialized. And their skills are therefore less valuable. And so they're working, but they're doing generic work. And as a result, it pays poorly. Work that, if you're doing something that everybody can do or can become productive in the course of a week or a month, you just don't have job security. You're not going to have a favorable lifetime earnings profile. So I'm concerned about this more broadly. I think AI may do this to many more types of work, not just limited to the middle, but moving up the value chain relatively quickly. The one thing I would say, there is a countervailing force to this, which is that there's also new work created. There's not a finite set of activities. Some, and as more and more are automated, there's just less and less, fewer and fewer things for people to do. We know that work has become over time more specialized, more expert. You know, in recent work that I have with Caroline Chin and Anna Solomons and Brian Segmiller, we show that about 60% of the work that people do in 2018 didn't exist in 1940. They're doing newly specialized work, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in communications, whether it's in research, or whether it's in, you know, expert services like tattooing or counseling or even sommelier services, which, you know, are relatively new in America, not in France, obviously. So both of these forces are going on. It's not simply automation is eroding, opportunity. It also creates new ones. But the set of people who benefit are often not the same as the set of people who are harmed. So the people who are doing great work now, are not the people who were displaced from factory floors and offices.
You pointed out at one of my next question, because you've been looking at the data about the creation of this new work, as you pointed out, from the 1940s to more or less now, right? And this is quite an important element, because of course, part of this conversation is saying it is not the end of work. It's the end of work as we know it, more or less, to simplify for our listeners. You've been looking through the data of these past decades. What have you been finding out? You know, what exactly we can learn as well from these several transitions? Because it looks like we've been in a transition, in a constant transition, rather than something that is like a big jump all of a sudden on one area or another, as we like also a little bit to portray the digital revolution, you know, to a certain extent, right?
Right. Well, we've been through multiple revolutions the last 200 years, and that's uncharacteristic, right? For most of human history, things moved a lot more slowly. you go 1,000 years and there wasn't much progress, but we went through an agricultural revolution, and then we went through an industrial revolution, and then we're in the midst of an information revolution. I'd say we're entering an AI revolution. And I don't use the word revolution lightly. I don't like to say, you know, internet 4.0 and blah, blah. I think that's ridiculous. But these are actually meaningful transitions. These are really significant transitions. I can summarize the work that I've done with Chin and Solomons and Segmiller, you know, very briefly in a few points. One is that a lot of work has been eliminated, right? So for example, you know, in the US at the turn of the 20th century, 40% of employment was in agriculture.
Or what about horses? Horses. There were horses everywhere.
That's right. Exactly. Now under 2% of employment is in agriculture. But simultaneously, there's been creation of a lot of new work and new services, new professional specialties, you know, entirely new industries that didn't exist. And what I mean by new work, I don't just mean more jobs. I mean people requiring expertise and knowledge and specialization that they previously didn't have. So when someone becomes a pediatric oncologist, right, that's a new type of service. That's a new body of knowledge. When someone becomes a solar plumber, right, a plumber who works on solar installation sites, that's a new type of knowledge. When someone becomes a tattooer, well, you know, that is, at least for them, is new. Obviously, tattoos have been around a long time, although they've become much more popular. So that's one finding. That's one important result, I think, you know, kind of a regularity that we, you know, worked hard to try to document. A second is that the locus of new work creation has shifted a lot over time. So in the first four post-World War II decades, a lot of the new work was concentrated in the middle, in production work, in clerical work, in office work. And then over the last four decades, since 1980, it's really bifurcated. A lot of the newly introduced jobs are either in these high-end specialties that require a lot of formal training or, you know, college degree, and increasingly also in services and personal services, but those tend to be low paid. So that's a second finding. So where new work is showing up has sort of led the trend of where work has shifted more broadly. And the third point is that, you know, how does this relate to technology? We show that there are measurably two faces of innovation. One is automation, which is replacing human work with machines, a task that used to be done by a person, done by a machine. And the other is what we call augmentation, or what Asmoglu and Restrepo would call reinstatement. And this is the creation of technologies that basically increase the value of the quality, the variety, the capabilities of things that people are already doing. So that should not, although that sounds kind of abstract, most of what we do, we use tools that augment us, right? So you wouldn't say your computer replaces you. You'd say your computer allows you to accomplish more. You know, your microphone isn't taking the place of your voice, right? It's allowing you to speak over a long distance, right? So many, many tools that make our labor more valuable. And so we should bear in mind that those tools are part of productivity growth and also part of the creation of new demands for specialization. Both of these things are going on, but it is really critical to notice that who's getting augmented has been over the last four decades, people with high levels of education, who are being automated, people in the middle. And it's quite possible that we are now in the course of another phase change where those loci are located, excuse me, where those things happen is different with different set of occupations.
Maria, you've been looking at those issues that David just mentioned, this augmentation, automation, especially going a little bit more in depth into the technology designed to substitute, complement, or reconfigure specific tasks executed by humans within sectors. What else we can add to this?
What I think we've been doing, which is intriguing and interesting within this Horizon Pillars project, Pathways to Inclusive Labor Market, what we've been doing is looking into the sort of engineering and technical literature. As economists, we've been, scoping a lot of technical details on what these technologies really are about. So we sort of unpacked the technical characteristics of each technologies to really go into the sort of human-machine interaction in a very technical way. And I'm really proud to have done that. We looked at over 4,000 records of technical literature, and we classified digital automation technologies across 8 technology families, among which, for example, those that are more data-driven and data management, data acquisition, user-computer interfaces vis-a-vis other more traditional, like traditional within this context, like AI and robotization, right? And what we have tried to do from the technical perspective, but as economists, which I think is a nice multidisciplinary addition to this literature, is really looking into the sort of nature of jobs. I mean, job classification often hide a lot of variety of tasks that people do within an occupation. And we have tried to address the sort of reconfiguration of tasks rather than the sort of replacement or creation of new jobs, which I think is also a nice element to look at when we discuss about the future of work. And ideally, what we looked at is basically because we concentrated on basically the technical literature that was currently the subject of research, development, prototypes, initial deployment of automation technologies, we were trying to look at what tasks were replaced and or reconfigured. And I think this gives us a lot of interesting insights on this. So obviously what David was saying about middle-skilled jobs, but also the fact that we've been seeing about the sort of emerging capabilities of new tasks that have to rely and relate to different forms of automation. So while, for example, technologies like robotization and AI and information systems have more of a sort of substitution effect, then, for example, it was interesting to see that, for example, many of the data-driven technologies like data intensive and so on rather complements a lot of service tasks. So where the human elements is still very important in activities and occupations that are exposed to data-driven technologies. And I think this distinction between data-intensive technologies and sort of robotization slash automation ones is extremely interesting to explore in the next future to see how the future of work is evolving in this. I mean, let's look at what specific tasks, what is complementing and substituting, but also reconfiguring, and what is the extent to which these technologies actually impact or permeate different sectors and different activities. So I guess the secret is also to unpack what's behind the word machine, and I think it's important to do it. So stay tuned on the results of this project. I'm really looking forward to discuss more.
Coming from what you just said, Maria, but also from the reflections that David had a few seconds ago, I would like to ask you a little bit more of a broader question, actually two, but I will start with the first one, which comes really from the social impact of what you're describing. David seems to clearly outline a dynamic where it's the middle range, basically the white collar kind of jobs, or I could say like the middle class kind of jobs, what made in the post-war boom period a certain critical mass of prosperity as well for societies. Basically, the real problem is that there is disappearance of this class of workers somehow, or at least a radical transformation of this class of workers. So I have a challenge for both of you. How do you see this radical transformation of the middle class, seeing the consequences of automation and augmentation linked to the digitalization?
I think it's been a big problem for the middle class. You know, I think in many countries, we see a kind of the kind of political lines hardening between the educated elite who've really benefited from these forces and folks who did traditional skilled work, but not as elite, that have really been, set back by these forces because a lot of the work that their expertise has, in some sense, been devalued by automation, right? And I don't mean devalued in a sociological value judgment sense. I mean that the skills that they had that were scarce for office work, for production work, are not scarce. They're less scarce because machines can do them very cheaply. There are just many fewer workers doing that work, and those were some of the best jobs that were available to people without a college degree. So I think it's a very serious problem. I also think that there are things we can do about it. They're not easy. I'm happy to talk about that, but let me pause.
Thank you. And Maria, do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I think I'm very much in line with what David's saying. I mean, that's very concerning. Also the issues, I mean, I have colleagues that have been discussing about the sort of political and social unrest that all this might lead to. And this is also has a very geographical characterization that, Giuseppe, you know better than us about this. I think we should focus on what actions are more effective in this sense. And I think there's a wide range of concerted policies that we might think about it. So it's not only about labor market policies. I think we should think about migration policies related to labor market. And what we do actually in this project is also look at the sort of upstream segment of this, which is education system, and how, for example, they're able to catch up with the speed of technological advances. So I think policy should look at a wide variety of actions along the value chain of technology and work. So, educating people to flexibility and to adaptation to these new technologies, but also favoring, for example, on the job training and something that would allow workers in that particular range that David has beautifully described to really get re-included in a labor market that otherwise would exclude them. And I think it is a matter of thinking of in a concerted way in terms of policy action on labor markets. And this is something, this is a real challenge that I think we should all reflect upon as academics and as policymakers and on the future of work.
And David, on the other side of the Atlantic, is there a similar discussion? I mean, I suppose there are discussions you were just saying about what kind of solutions or what kind of actions could be taken within this frame that we have just described.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion. And I think the Biden administration has actually been active in trying to address some of these things. For example, creating regional investment to stimulate, you know, job growth, and not just any jobs, but kind of expert centers, restoring kind of, you know, centers of excellence in different technological areas rather than just having them, you know, fly out all to the coasts. It's trying to invest in skills training, in education, also in revitalizing the labor movement to increase bargaining power of workers. I personally think that a very important avenue to be explored and to try is changing the way that employers hire. We have, over the last four decades, probably more so in the US than anywhere else, like gotten to this sort of college or bust mindset, where almost all of the, you know, well-paying, stable jobs are available exclusively to people with four-year college degrees, which is a minority of the workforce, right? It's about 35 to 40% of the workforce. And it's especially a minority of minorities. So, you know, only about 25% of Black and Hispanic males in the United States, for example, have a four-year college degree. So if you're going to say that only those good jobs are available only to people with that degree, well, you're excluding a huge number of people. But moreover, college grads have gotten expensive. And we're entering a period of labor scarcity because of, demographic slowdown, lower fertility, and also, at least in the United States, highly, highly restricted immigration, which is very unfortunate. And I think employers are going to have to get better at figuring out how to use talent and figuring out how can we, you know, hire people without an elite degree and make them productive in this work. Maybe we're kind of focusing too much on credentials. And how can we use technology to augment those people and make their skills more valuable, give them support, give them guardrails? AI is not just a human replacing tool. It's also a decision support tool, right? It's also an information provision tool. So can't we use the technology to make to augment ourselves, not exclusively to replace ourselves?
If I may add, I think in line with this, I think what is, I guess what it's coming up as well is this role of soft skills that might be related to what David was mentioning. So ideally, this sort of revitalizing the human side of this and of the labor market. And this is something that probably cannot be formally trained, but I think we can all support this. And I think this is helping exactly those segments of the labor markets that are less formally educated.
But I would like, if I can, I would like to go back, because we are going towards the end of this episode, I would like to go back to the initial question from Paul Krugman, because you've been quite very well analyzing the two ends and the fact that the middle is being automated. But the initial question was, what if the high end is going to start to be automated? And that might sound science fiction. I mean, of course, the release of ChatGPT in the past few weeks has been drawing us from the science fiction scenario into the reality of what the near future might lead us to. So, if the same fate of the middle class will be given to this highly educated college graduate and so forth cohorts, what is there to expect, or is that an exaggeration of what can happen?
I think it's actually a real concern. There are many, you know, kind of managerial and decision making jobs that essentially involve taking some quantitative data, observations on the world, what are the costs, what are the shipping times, and then some qualitative data about, you know, what do people want, what's the market, what's the trend, blah, 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 and putting them together to make decisions, right? And you might say, well, machines aren't really that good at that, but then people aren't really that good at that either, right? So they're not that hard to improve upon. So I think it's quite possible that AI will move more, you know, kind of automation into these decision-making tasks. And some of that will be in the decision support role, will be very constructive. So I think in medicine, for example, we'll see lots of AI for decision support. I don't think it'll obviate the need for doctors, but I think it'll make them better doctors. But I do worry about this wholesale replacement in these other activities. Now, and that creates a real challenge, because there may be other productive things for people to do. I think there will be, but we don't know what they are. And certainly they may not know what they are, and it may require additional training or schooling. So I think it's a very legitimate concern, and we don't know what determines what is augmented and what is automated, where that locus is, how fast it happens. But I do think AI in particular is very difficult to predict because it's improving so much faster than anyone would have predicted it, short of, Paul Hinton and Jan LeCun, right? Everybody else thought this can't, even my colleagues in the computer science department at MIT, computer science, 10 years ago, they're like, no, it seems to be making incremental progress, but really it's going to hit the upper limit really soon. You just can't go this far with this model-free, just throw data at it and processing power, not going to happen. And it's happening. I mean, I think all of us are taken aback. So it used to be that I could make a confident prediction about what would be automated or computerized. I say, look, well, you got to figure out the rules. You got to code them in software. You got to test them a billion times, right? It's like, it's a very slow incremental progress, way of progressing. But that's no longer the case because AI uses inductive reasoning, right? It doesn't need to know the rules, right? You don't need to teach it. It just infers from what it's seeing what you're supposed to do. And so I don't actually know what the upper limit is on that. And I don't know how fast it's going to move. So I think it's we should be pretty humble about what we can predict.
It's a legitimate question, definitely. Maria, would you like to have a last take on that since we started with that and somehow we went back to circle to that?
Yeah, we were back to circle, in fact. And I think I just wanted to go back to my initial reflection about the nature of knowledge and what actually makes humans vis-a-vis AI collecting data and reproducing and imitating human behavior on top of data, that what makes us unique and what is really valuable in terms of knowledge reproduction. I think we should probably, from the academic perspective, I think this is the question to answer. I mean, what is the that makes important the role of so-called tacit knowledge that is not imitable, right? And therefore that makes us really indispensable as production factor, as a labor, human labor. And I think this is important to monitor how this technological progress is actually changing the boundaries between tacit and codified knowledge. And this is probably the sort of ingredient we might need to monitor to see what's going to happen in the future and kind of jobs, a high-end job, as you call them, will be affected.
Absolutely. And I see that David wants to add something on that. I want to give the mic to you just 1 second, because what Maria said, I was just thinking about something about we as being humans and this whole discussion about augmentation, where somehow without being, I don't want to sound anti-machines or anti-digitalization, but there is a real concern about losing certain skills that we as humans have been acquiring for thousands and thousands of years by not just simply not doing certain things anymore ourselves and by letting other machines, algorithms doing the thinking for us. Isn't there a risk that we are going to, instead of augment our capacity as human beings, there is a risk that we are going to lose something in terms of our own biological skills, which makes us humans?
I mean, I think there's a risk that we will delegate to machines many difficult, high-stakes decisions and not really understand what machines are going to do, right? Think about machines used in warfare. They have much faster reflexes than we do. They have access to much more data. You know, they could make life and death decisions faster than we can. Should we allow them to do that? I mean, I probably would say no, but I'm sure in my lifetime we will. And just to respond to Maria's point about tacit knowledge, I think this is the kind of crucial boundary that AI has crossed. It used to be impossible to give a computer tacit knowledge because everything we programmed it to do, we had to first understand explicitly. And that was, Polanyi's paradox. Polanyi said, we know more than we can tell. But if you can't tell it, you couldn't tell it to a computer. However, now computers can tacitly understand things that we don't know, and they can't tell us what they're doing. I call this Polanyi's revenge, right? Computers can master problems, and they can't explain to us how they did what they did. Why did it make this decision? Why did you take that turn, not this turn? How did you come up with a faster method of matrix manipulation? How did you master Go, the game of Go, right? The machine does it. It does it using... But we actually don't understand what it's doing. And so it is acquiring tacit knowledge. And it's still the case that TASS acknowledges we can't communicate it. It can't communicate it to us. We can't communicate it to it. But it has moved into a domain that we thought was really exclusively ours. So I do think it's quite humbling, and it's hard to forecast with confidence where that goes.
I think Carpolani revenge is actually what sums it all, really. And the point is exactly this, is really revisiting this knowledge transfer, receiving sender, who we're not humans anymore. As my colleague is also, we pointed out in this project, we are cyber physical systems, and we need to probably to revisit the whole functioning of technology human interaction in this context.
Well, and obviously the words of both of you resonates with me, but I would like just to read for our listeners, and of course you know them by heart, the three laws of robotics of Isaac Asimov, because obviously whatever you've been saying here, David, resonates with what Isaac had been writing decades ago. So a robot might not injure a human being, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Perhaps something that we should remind ourselves. And with this, I would like to thank both of you, Maria and David, for this excellent conversation we had. And I would like to remind also our listeners that in the show notes, they will find the link to the project page of the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future of Work. And that, as usual, they can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.brugel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to speak.
Thank you so much. Really, pleasure mine. Thank you.
And until next time, bye-bye.